Hello and welcome to Walkley Talks. I'm James Gorman from the Walkley Foundation for Journalism. Here we share discussions about the craft and importance of journalism in Australia and the world, often recorded at our events. Today's podcast is from our Regional Journalism Summit held earlier in 2022. This panel, How Can We Sustain Regional Journalism, was curated by the Public Interest Journalism Institute. It features an international panel of experts exploring how policy, philanthropy, and public buy-in can intersect to secure the future for public interest journalism across our communities. This talk was recorded as part of the Walkley Regional Journalism Summit on February 10.
Thanks, Lisa. And I'd just like to appreciate the warm welcome and like to acknowledge the land from which I'm meeting today. So I'm on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and just like to acknowledge elders past, present and emerging, including any of those joining us today. So welcome, everyone. Before I introduce our esteemed panellists, who come from us from the sleepy hours in the UK, the more sociable hours of the afternoon in the US, and here in Australia, I'm just going to help set the scene a little from a Pidgey perspective of where we're up to and introduce some of our new data, which we just released yesterday. So since Pidgey was established just over 3 years ago, there's been more change than anyone would have thought possible in the news media landscape, not just in Australia, but as we'll see today, worldwide. We all know the importance and demand for reliable news media to deliver accurate information, counteract misinformation, disinformation. We'll be discussing the hyper-local needs and equally touching on one of those important points from the Bushfire Royal Commission about news's role as emergency infrastructure. But of course, these recent events have also exposed news's vulnerability. Our Australian Newsroom Mapping Project has tracked more than 400 changes since the beginning of 2019. Two-thirds of these changes, both positive and negative, have been concentrated in regional and remote Australia. Of total activity, roughly two-thirds, and this is across regional and metropolitan markets, were market contractions. That's a sharp acceleration from previous ACCC data that had shown 106 news closures over the 10-year period between 2008 and 18. Of particular interest, our data shows that nearly 70% of all contractions are skewed to the regions. And of those contractions, they are more likely to be closures or decreased services of local titles, whereas the metropolitan experience is more likely to have ended in an end of print edition, which is seen as a lesser type of contraction. Pidgey has just released a new set of data looking at the baseline of news production, which shows 800 outlets so far, and that's been based on 2,000 community submissions. Of the 537 local government areas across Australia, our new data now shows that there are 33 areas without print or digital news coverage. That doesn't include broadcasting data, which we'll be adding later in the year. But just to give you some characteristics of these areas, they are all regional or remote. They are all with small populations, and they all generally have low population density in that they're covering a large geography. Some examples include the Central Highlands in Tasmania, Balranald and Central Darling in New South Wales, Quilpie and the Cherbourg Aboriginal Shire in Queensland, and the Upper Gascoyne in Western Australia. Coupled with Pidgey's prior research done prior to 2019, That suggests declines in coverage of local government activity. We're faced with a pretty challenging picture. While green shoots have emerged, they mostly reflect the trend towards digital delivery, which doesn't assist vulnerable cohorts such as digital literacy amongst the elderly, the cost of technology as a barrier for the disadvantaged, nor the connectivity issues for remote communities, particularly covering Aboriginal communities. So where does this leave us, and what is the path forward for public interest journalism? Today we've brought together a panel of experts to help us dive into deep conversation on the future of public interest journalism and how it may be secured through a combination of policy, philanthropy, and public buy-in. This discussion will take about 20 minutes. Presenters are going to give us some quick insights into their organisation, and then we'll open up to audience questions. So we'll ask that you pop questions into the chat room at any stage as we go. And now to our panellists. So starting with Natalie. Natalie Eggleton is the CEO of the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal, FRRR. Nat's 25-year background has spanned the non-profit and corporate sectors with strengths in strategy, program evaluation and research analysis. She joined FRRR in 2012 to manage natural disaster recovery and preparedness programs, as well as projects addressing social innovation. Since becoming FRRR's CEO in 2015, they have facilitated over $800 million in funding to regional and remote communities through hundreds of partnerships and collaborations. Nat is based in Maldon in central Victoria, for those wondering where her locale is. Sue Cross is the CEO of the Institute for Nonprofit News, INN, in the US. She's the former Senior Vice President for the Associated Press, where she created digital news services, expanded Spanish language and Latin American operations, and introduced video to over 1,000 online news sites. Her previous background included Regional Vice President, AP's Los Angeles Bureau Chief, and she directed news coverage and media operations in Chicago, Phoenix, and Dallas. So picking up on the Texan theme, she also began her early reporter career in Alaska and Ohio. Sue joined INN in 2015 as their CEO, and her focus has been building its emerging networks and advancing its social enterprise models for investigative and other public service journalism. She also sits on a number of media-related boards, and Sue is coming to us from Los Angeles in the US. And lastly, moving to Jonathan. Jonathan began his career as a journalist at The Observer and went on to spend 7 years as the director of English Pen, where he campaigned for free speech and media freedom. He's written for many newspapers and magazines, including The Telegraph, The Independent, The Guardian, and the British Journalism Review, to name a few, as well as publishing his own book, The Press Freedom Myth. In 2015, he founded and led Impress, the independent press regulator, until he moved across with the launch of the Public Interest News Foundation, PIMF, in late 2019, which is where we first met. Jonathan's also a senior research fellow at the University of Stirling and a committee member at the Joseph Rounting Charitable Trust, among other interests. Welcome to our panellists. So, Nat, I might start with you and wondering if perhaps you could share a bit of an overview around FRRR's work and where you see some resonance for the purposes of today's discussion.
Thanks, Anna, and it's really wonderful to be here. As the introduction outlined, I am in Maldon in central Victoria, so I would just like to acknowledge and pay respect to Dja Dja Wurrung people, who are the traditional owners and custodians of country here in central Victoria. Brief overview of FRRR for those that don't know us so well. FRRR is a national philanthropic organisation which is structured as a partnership mechanism to enable giving to reach regional communities. But it's also a hybrid organisation that does a lot of capacity building. So we're better known for our grant-making work, but it's actually quite a dynamic organisation that leverages a whole range of capabilities that intend to influence a whole range of outcomes, which are essentially around greater equitable access to living well across Australia, regardless of location and distance. So we do funding and development, and that is through many, many partnerships. We partner with governments, philanthropy, corporates, and, of course, individuals who want to give. We do have a priority and focus on smaller and more remote communities and those that are likely to be disadvantaged or experience greater barriers in accessing capital to support their objectives. And within that grant funding, there's a lot of coaching capacity building work that we do with local community leaders. We also play a brokerage role where we assist those wanting to give to understand how they can put their money to work in the best way possible. So sometimes that involves advising, sometimes it involves actually distributing that money and helping that money reach places that that those partners can't reach themselves for a range of reasons. We've got a YouTube channel that has a wealth of insights and on-ground kind of perspective about what's happening in communities and how local communities are addressing the challenges that they're experiencing. And I'll share with you in a moment the summary results of a study that we conducted last year. So our strategy is really anchored around three intersecting and co-dependent domains, I suppose, which are around people and investing in local not-for-profits, leadership capacity, volunteer-led efforts, which we know most rural communities thrive off the back of volunteer-led efforts, and really investing in the capacity and capability of people within communities. We recognise that place and locational context is critical to designing any kind of service system or intervention. We need to work from a sort of locational perspective. And we also appreciate and recognise that disaster resilience and climate solutions are really the biggest threats that are facing many of our regional communities, and we are seeing that play out day by day at the moment. So our work is really through a lens of strengthening resilience and investing in community-led approaches. And we also recognise that any support and partnerships need to appreciate the cycle of development that communities are living and working through all the time, and that's a really dynamic, ever-moving set of conditions. So you can see there that the types of outcomes that we are interested in supporting and influencing are really quite holistic, and they're very much about the intersections of the enabling conditions that make places good, healthy communities, vibrant, sustainable places that can contribute to both their local regions but the broader national prosperity. So from our perspective at FRRR, in all of the work that we do across the country and across the different partnerships that we have, it really, these intersecting and coalescing issues, I think, that are becoming more and more concentrated in the regions, are calling on a different type of investment and better investment in the resilience of the systems, organisations and networks. Siloed approaches are really unhelpful and typically exacerbate existing barriers and structural issues. What we think some of the great, I guess, resilience elements are within communities and within systems to be well invested in, and communities work really well when they have access and trusted and relevant and accurate are probably the critical pieces there. Connectedness and relationships, which is around social capital and being able to link and bridge and bring in opportunity. Shared visioning, adaptive dynamic skills. We hear a lot about leadership, but it's more than leadership. It's actually about the ability to advocate and do things differently as required. We tend to focus on funding localised organisations that are in and off their place, and really think about those as anchor type organisations. They're the foundations that, if you have strong, robust organisations within these types of domains, you will be, you know, in a far better place to sustain your community and to sustain the opportunities that might be available to you or that you need to advocate for. And that's just a really small set of examples, but they're the types of organisations that we tend to target our support to. And the other, I guess, unsurprising but increasingly concerning piece is that underinvestment or poorly structured investment in these types of requirements and sort of conditions in communities is showing up critically during crisis. And they're often retrospectively attended to. Anna mentioned natural disasters and the Bushfire Royal Commission highlighting the need for better media and coverage. And that's just one example. But we see it time and time again, and increasingly in really exacerbated circumstances where the disaster is far worse as a result of the lack of investment. And we see that in bushfires, where we have lack of community infrastructure, lack of telecommunications infrastructure, you know, inability to communicate through radio frequencies, etc., you know, really impacting on safety and lives. We've seen it in the pandemic, and we see it when there are regulatory or policy changes which create disruptions that could have been, prepared for, we think. And, of course, news deserts and the data that Anna and her team have developed is really concerning. Notably, those deserts are in areas that have really low socioeconomic profiles and are already facing significant vulnerability. So absence of news is very concerning there. So we conducted a national survey called the Heartbeat of Rural Australia. We received 638 responses from across the country. Significant majority were volunteer run with no or very limited paid staff. And we were interested in understanding the cumulative impacts of natural disasters, including the pandemic, really trying to express and understand the value and the role of those organisations from an economic, social, cultural perspective. They're a voice that are hard to hear and a voice that's hard to reach, particularly for policymakers. So we were interested in really bringing that hyper-local perspective up into broader view. So a couple of the charts are here just in terms of some of the core barriers. Internet connectivity is a pretty simple one. And when we're talking about news access and digital transitions, we need to think about the fact that access is really poor in a lot of communities. The ability to actually influence change was a really interesting analysis as well. And that comes down to the advocacy potential, but also the validity of their voice needing to be heard more. Short sort of story about the impacts is pretty concerning. Significant sense of uncertainty in rural communities. The pandemic restrictions on top of what had already been really strong conditions in a lot of communities, particularly on the eastern seaboard. And we're going to see this again in WA as those fires go through the wheat belt at the moment. The lockdowns and restrictions just caused a significant amount of fragility. Organisations that relied entirely on event fundraising, for example, show societies, ag shows, the community groups that raise money for the local CFA, for example, none of them could do their work in terms of fundraising and events, and there was a significant lack of preparedness. Volunteer efforts are very depleted, people are exhausted, and they're really wondering about how to go forward. So it's pretty concerning, but not all completely dire. Some of the commentary that we found really powerful was just about what would happen if these organisations didn't exist and the imperative to really support them and keep them going. And essentially, you know, in many smaller remote communities, a lot of things just wouldn't happen and the community would actually probably wither and die eventually without them. So just in a nutshell, to close out, it is both a pretty harrowing story. There are less people doing more, we know that, and they're keeping critical services going. Within that, though, is a really beautiful opportunity to back local communities. Communities are taking the lead on quite critical things, but it makes sense for them to take the lead. They know what they need. What they actually need is better resourcing and better support to do that. That includes things like some of the projects that we've supported, investing in radio towers that are used during emergencies, you know, enabling communities to really drive that investment is really powerful, gives confidence to the community that they can handle things when they happen. Equipment for volunteer emergency services, community newsletters, social media pages, you know, there's a really great mobilising occurring, but again, it needs resourcing. Philanthropy is stepping in, but philanthropy is not the long game answer. Philanthropy is there to help fill gaps, support pilots, test new models. We can take risks. We can back things that haven't been tested yet and ideally prove up the efficacy of new models, new approaches. But it's really not the long-term answer, so we do need some longer-term thinking. There is a need for longer-term investment in capacity building as well. And people, it's more than money. It's about people, it's about skills, and it's about access to capacity building for them to really be able to handle what's coming at them. And it is more than leadership, I would argue. So information, networks, the appreciation and investment in the hyper-local context and investment in diverse voices are really the critical ingredients from our perspective. And regional media is obviously a key element of that. And I would argue that if we're looking ahead and thinking about how we sustain rural communities, there's a real movement happening around place-based investment, for example. We need local information and news to actually be part of the core mix in this. And to date, I don't think that's been factored in as one of the core sort of resilience factors, and that's one that I would be advocating for more investment in as well. Thanks, Anna. I'll stop there.
Fantastic, Matt. Thanks. You've given us a great overview of the issues facing regional and rural Australia. Jonathan, I might pass to you now in terms of giving us an overview from the UK and what introducing PIMF and its work and what you're focusing on.
Thanks, Anna. It's good to see you. Good to see you. Well, I'm sadly, I can't see the 150 or so people who are watching us, but I'm nice to know that you're out there. So I'm going to talk briefly about the Public Interest News Foundation and the situation in the UK and how we see ourselves trying to address that. I think, first of all, it's really important to say how great it is to be working with Anna, Nat, Sue and others, both in Australia and in the US and in other places. You know, we're talking today about local news and in some cases, tiny, fragmented, remote communities. But we're also dealing with global issues, which we're all sharing and all grappling with at the same time. And it's amazing now, and partly thanks to the wonders of Zoom, that we can actually routinely meet and talk to each other and learn and share experiences. So, you know, I was a journalist, as Anna said in her introduction. I worked at the Observer newspaper. I love journalism, but I think we have to be frank. It's a mess. We talk about a crisis, but let's call a spade a spade. Journalism is in a mess. Sales have collapsed. Advertising revenue has collapsed. And in the UK, we've lost about 265 local newspapers in the last 15 years. And bear in mind, we are a geographically small country. That's a lot of local areas to lose their title. We've just in the last couple of days seen another merger announced between two of the four biggest regional newspaper groups. So we're moving towards an ever smaller group of monopoly companies at the top of the industry. And I think we need to recognize that this crisis in journalism isn't just economic. I think for many of the reasons that Natalie has outlined, it's a social problem as well. If the public don't trust their news organizations, if they don't have that kind of relationship with news organizations where they think the journalists are on their side, where they believe what they say, where they believe that journalists are speaking from experiences that they share, then audiences are just simply not going to switch on the news. They're not going to pay for it. They're not going to buy it. And if they do, they're going to quickly move on to another source of information, because to them, they're going to struggle to understand what is it that's special about journalism. So we've got these two different debates, I think, going on. There's within the industry, there's an economic debate. Lots of journalists, editors and publishers, you know, we go around wringing our hands saying, how can we persuade the audience to pay? And the audience are really saying to us, why should we even read it, let alone pay for it? You know, we've got other things to do with our time. We don't think you are on our side. And I think for too long, people in the industry have been ignoring that trust data, which I think in any other industry would sound a really powerful warning sign about what's going wrong. But I think one of the promising signs, we did some research last year in the UK, which is on the screen here, with characteristic findings of, you know, a minority of the population would trust a national news organization. In our case, we found a really small proportion would trust a local news organization that's not based in the area, whereas a quite high proportion would trust a local news organization that is based in the area, a significantly higher net positive trust rating for genuinely homegrown local news, as opposed to what I'm afraid, because of that industry consolidation, we too often see, which is news that's being flown in our case, 100 miles away, in your case in Australia, perhaps 1,000 miles away, from people who we don't really recognize as really being from our community, understanding our concerns, speaking for us. So I think those two issues, the economic and the social, are deeply intertwined, and we need to bring them together in our thinking about the solution. I won't reiterate this. Natalie has already covered the drivers of social sustainability and also the benefits of focusing on social sustainability for businesses. There's a lot of evidence that businesses that are really geared towards social sustainability, towards those measures of equity, diversity, democracy, thinking about quality of life, that is good for business. So social sustainability and economic sustainability are two sides of the same coin, and we need to approach them in that spirit. So at the Public Interest News Foundation, we're a new charity in the UK, set up only in the last 2.5 years. We can talk more in the discussion about other activities that we do, but I'm just going to spend a minute highlighting a particular program that we launched last year. So this is called our Impact Fund. We are trying to really put to the test the idea that journalism is good for local democracy. So I think loads of us on this call probably take that as absolutely just fact of nature. Of course, journalism is good for democracy. That's why we care about journalism. Many of us are journalists, and we just grew up believing that. And I think journalism is good for local democracy, but I'd like to know how and what makes it particularly good. You know, if it's good for local democracy, let's make sure that the journalism that we're doing is as good as possible for local democracy. Let's not take it for granted that because we're covering the local council or the local courts, that actually translates into positive measures of democratic engagement. So we're kind of running an experiment. We've raised some funding, which we are then awarding in grants to 5 local news organisations in London and Birmingham, our 2 biggest cities. These are all homegrown local organisations, so the kind that should command higher trust from their audiences. And in each case, they're doing something to try to enhance, deepen, flesh out, enrich their coverage of local democracy. That might be holding more hustings. It might be getting together members of the community to ask what matters to them and then making sure that their coverage addresses those concerns. In one case, they're running what we call the Gogglebox experiment, where they're actually filming a bunch of local candidates for election and then filming the response of local residents. So you see the resident sitting on their sofa in their flat in South London, watching the candidates saying, oh, I like that one, don't like that one, that one's speaking a lot of sense, don't believe that, why haven't they addressed the question about traffic, about air quality? And then that video is then put out to the audience through the newspaper's website so that normal people see people like them engaging with politics, and the idea is maybe that will encourage those other viewers and readers to get more engaged themselves. But we're not just going to sort of do that and hope for the best. We're then going to measure the impact. We're going to look at voter turnout in those electoral wards in London and Birmingham. And we're doing some qualitative research to actually understand people's attitudes before and after these bits of journalism have run. So that's one way in which, if that goes well and the data confirms our hunch, it's going to give us some really valuable evidence that we think is going to help those news organisations to become more socially sustainable, but also, we hope, more economically sustainable. Because if they can really deepen those relationships with their audience, it's going to have the benefits that we spoke about in terms of improving loyalty and trust and likelihood of buying in to their offer. But we can also use that where there is a real market failure and there just isn't an audience that can generate revenue. It can help us make the case to philanthropists and policymakers to put more support into the sector along the lines that Natalie described a few moments ago. And I think most importantly, we can actually use it to work with publishers to say, look, of those 5 initiatives that we supported in London and Birmingham, these ones had an amazing impact. These ones, not so much, they're okay, but you know, but this and this, this, here are some great ideas. Do that, you're going to enhance your democratic coverage, you're going to enrich your relationship with your community, and maybe that will also contribute to your economic sustainability. So I will stop there. That's just a quick highlight of one particular program that we're running to try to crack this, you know, I think really difficult but not impossible challenge of how do we actually sustain local news, not just in the UK, but wherever we are.
Thanks, Jonathan. And now we'll cross to the US to you, Sue. Just you're heading up a peak of more than 300 independent nonprofit news organisations. So really interesting to hear about INN's experience and the types of programs that you capture.
Thank you, Anna and Jonathan. That was really interesting. So INN is a network that was formed 12 years ago by a small group of investigative journalism outfits, 27 of them at the time, that wanted to preserve journalism of a type that was under threat by all these same economic threats that you're hearing about today. The situation really isn't any different in the U.S. We've had about 60,000 journalism jobs lost, most of those in newspapers. This network, I'm going to talk about what's developed in the U.S. and tie it into your rural situation a bit. The important thing I'd say about these 360, you can obviously see the growth in that. But what has enabled this growth across the U.S. is growing as a network. So about half of these news organizations are now local. About a third of them are really local, a town or a community or a neighborhood within a city. And then the rest of that half are statewide organizations, often covering our state level of government. They are community driven, meaning they have to be supported by their community. So they usually start by reaching out and identifying those community needs versus being part of a profitable news organization that might be oriented more toward the kind of news that's going to drive ad revenue. They operate as shared newsrooms. The average nonprofit newsroom in the U.S. shares its news with more than 10 other news outlets, most of those commercial, some digital platforms, and so forth. And they're highly focused on original reporting. So they are actually, it takes all kinds of product shape, but they are going out and doing the feet on the street reporting that's been lost across the country. So I'm going to switch to talking about data just a little bit, but the data isn't really about the data itself. We have been tracking the growth of this field so that we can see what is working, what isn't working, what successes can be copied and shared for about 5 years through an annual survey called the INN Index. I did pop one finding on the right. We often get questions from around the world about how does local news sustain itself now as a nonprofit? So this is the average in the U.S., that pie chart. If you are a local news nonprofit, about 45% of your funding is coming from grants and foundations. About 30% is coming from individuals, might be readers who donate small amounts or just others who support your work. And then about a quarter of their revenue is now earned revenue. That's often sponsorship, sometimes events, underwriting, things like that. What is important under the idea of this data is what it says about what is working to sustain news in small communities. And it is this networking. This data really represents quite an astonishing new way of doing business. We just finished the last data collection, and 95% of our members invested time that'll help them a little bit and help the whole field a lot by sharing their data. They open up their books, they share all their revenue, they share how they spend it on people, the kind of news they're covering. And it really is a new model of growing as a network. You see them all investing in lifting all boats. We also, out of this data, can see opportunities form as this field develops. And some of that, by the way, has come from sharing information with those of you in Australia and with Jonathan's organization in the UK. There's a lot to be learned globally. One of the things we found across the US was that we had 60 members covering rural areas and covering rural issues and rural life in the US. Now, in the U.S., what media remains has become more and more concentrated in New York and then the West Coast, but primarily the East Coast, New York, D.C. So many, many rural areas have no news coverage or virtually none at all. And when we saw this data that there were this many newsrooms, we realized there's nothing else like this. There's no more coverage of rural issues across the U.S. And so these 60 members of INN formed a coalition within INN earlier this year to create a reporting consortium focused on covering these issues. You heard from Tim Merrima earlier today. He's one of the leading editors in that initiative. The first collaboration they're working on right now is around the economics around Indigenous communities. So similar to your First Nations, and they're looking at the economic trends in the rural areas around those communities, which just hasn't been reported in that way. The second collective thing I wanted to share with you that's happening in the U.S. is Newsmatch. This is something that all of our members with INN and with a coalition of funders join forces to do each year. It is the largest grassroots funding campaign for journalism. It runs at the end of each year in the United States. And it started when the major foundations decided to put up seed funding and match individual donations of up to $1,000 given to local news organizations. And when we started this, we worked in partnership with these foundations. Over the last 5 years, it's raised about $150 million. That doesn't include this last December. We haven't counted that yet. But what I want to point to on this chart is a thing that I think is significant and could be relevant there in Australia if adapted to your local market. When Newsmatch started, you can see that bar in purple, it was almost all national pool funds from the big foundations that fund journalism. By the time we get to 2021, these national pool funds have inspired local matching funds from family foundations, sometimes companies, social responsibility organizations, all kinds of things, and individual donations, so that the local funding and partner funding now exceeds the national match. And that tells us this thing is really starting to work, because as we need more and more news organizations to replace what's been lost, the national funding is only going to stretch so far, but we can now see it is a catalyst that's really transforming how communities support their local journalism. And in leading up to this, when we were in the planning calls, we talked about this. In the U.S., there's this big tradition. Individuals donate at the end of the year to whatever charities they want to support. And that's when we run Newsmatch at the end of the year. But you could adapt that in Australia to annual preparedness drives around national disasters, for example. If there are times of year or constructs where there's funding going out to make sure communities have resilience to prepare for disasters, could news funding be part of that, or a campaign like this be part of that? And we thought that was a really intriguing idea. We do think this idea is adaptable for various patterns. The last thing I'll say in this is, please reach out to us if you're interested in this. As I mentioned, we have exchanged data with Jonathan and shared some of the index construct there. We have learned from Pidgey and are really admiring what you're doing there in Australia. So we see global patterns in this. We are producing case studies of what's working in the U.S. and mining this data. We would be delighted to hear from you and work with anybody who wants to look at this globally and exchange what is working and what we can do together. Because I think we are seeing green shoots and a little beyond. We're really seeing some bright and very encouraging advances from where we sit around the world.
Thanks, Sue. That was really valuable insight. And as we can see across our three speakers, there's a real spirit of collaboration and sharing data and intellectual property, which I think is one of the core strengths that we can all really leverage off. I've got a number of questions, but first I might just throw to the questions coming through on the chat. So firstly, any panelists can jump in. There's a perception that city-based editors do not understand the working conditions in the regions and do not recognise stories important to regional communities. How can this gap be reduced, specifically when regional-based journalist is working for a larger news outlet based in one of the larger cities? Perhaps, Sue, you might have a comment there.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Here's what we see in the one reason the Rural News Network formed. I do think in the U.S. our news is more geared to metropolitan areas, or there's a kind of a split in the journalism field between large organizations and rural areas, which might have weeklies or smaller dailies. They're covering more local news, not the big story. One of the reasons we are so excited about the Rural News Network is we do see a difference in the news judgment. Typically, and I worked at the AP, we have a big national public broadcasting network that has excellent journalists. But when you organize a story from a national perspective or to spread out, you're looking at it differently. And what we're finding is we gather these newsrooms that are in very remote areas, rural communities, and just ask them, what's the big issue there? And always there's a common thread and they will surface a bigger story. And we're really excited about this because we think it's the opposite of parachute journalism. And I've been a parachute journalist and you drop in and you can write a story, but you don't really understand the culture or the economics or the stories of people underneath it the way a local reporter can. And so I do think there's a difference. There can be good journalism from both directions, but there is an authenticity in local coverage of local issues that I don't think you can replicate from outside.
Nat, have you got any comments to add that, coming from regional representation of what you've seen both for news but equally in other industries where there's regional versus the larger metropolitan company headquarters?
Look, as a non-journalist, I probably can't comment with a great deal of authority, but I mean, it's just a sense of logic, isn't it, about how you connect to authorising voices and stories and how you get feedback loops that are effective. And I think, in fact, it's really unhelpful to continue to... Unhelpful is not the right word. It's more helpful for us to think more holistically and think about how we do bridge these divides and how we create feedback mechanisms and loops that do allow the perspectives of regions to actually be more front of mind in metro. Very understandable that sitting in the city, it's very difficult to see and hear and have a true appreciation of what the conditions are in a rural or remote area.
Thanks, Nat. Now, Jonathan, a question for you. We've got someone online who's part of a group establishing a local and independent news association, and they've got two questions, wondering what the key elements are that make a hyperlocal news outlet relevant and effective, and secondly, how important it is to find ways of funding and supporting both for-profit and non-profit news outlets.
Thank you, whoever asked that question. Two really difficult parts to it. The key elements, I mean, the key element is, I think it's as Sue said, many of the successful examples in the States begin by asking the community what they need. And it sounds really, really simple. It's actually very hard to do, but it's important to do and, you know, reach out to others who've done it and learn how they've done it. Sometimes it means not just sending out a questionnaire or going on Facebook and asking a question. It means literally going to people where they are, going to shopping centres or pubs or cafes or going downtown and hanging out on the street and literally talking to people and understanding their attitudes and what they need and want from the media, and then doing your absolute damnedest to meet that. On the second part of the question about for-profit and non-profit, I think it's a really interesting one, that, because I'm a huge fan of Sue's work in the States with the nonprofit sector. In the UK, I think many of the news organizations that we see as comparable to the nonprofit news organizations in the States are actually for profits. They're small, they're social enterprises, they're small teams of people working for a bit of money and partly voluntarily. But they're not set up on a non-profit basis. And that's partly because we don't have the tax incentives for that in the UK. And it's partly just lack of know-how. You know, I speak to lots of people who say, oh, I set my thing up 5-10 years ago as a limited company because that was the only way I knew to create an organization. And now I realize it would have made more sense to set it up as a non-profit and get some people from the community to act as board members, and maybe even have a cooperative model where members of the community get to have a say in the running of the organization. That would be totally in line with my values, but I just didn't know how to do it at the time. So I think, yeah there are for-profits out there, and I think that's great. Let's have a nice mix of business models. But But I think some of those for-profits might need to ask themselves, is it actually the right model for what they want to achieve?
So turning to the question of business models and accepting funding from the digital platforms, we've got a question perhaps for Jonathan and Sue. If you could describe your relationship with the digital platforms in light of recent whistleblower revelations, as we've seen with Facebook, for those journalists interested in rebooting democracy, should you be so enthusiastic in embracing the Google News initiative? So let's start with you.
Yes, INN does get funding from both Facebook and Google News Initiative, usually around projects aimed at building the capacity of our members. Facebook donates to the Newsmatch pool. That doesn't come to INN. It goes all to our members. Google News Initiative has funded a lot of excellent training. I'd say a couple of things about it. I think it's really important that local news organizations in particular might work with these social media platforms to help people discover them, but it's really important to build a direct audience and not be dependent on them, because their needs do not meet, their mission is not the same as yours, and you need to be ready for their mission to shift. So I'd say work with the social platforms if they're useful to you in building something for your community, but try to build that as directly as you can. We have a lot of questions and concerns about both companies. Our position as a network has been, we will work with them to take advantage of what they are offering to media, to open up opportunities, and leave it to each of our members to decide, yeah, we want to take part in that or not. But we think it's a reasonable question for each news organization to ask. Overall, I think they have been helpful in building this new field in journalism. Their programs are excellent. But again, their mission and needs may not be the same as the news industry. And so I think you always have to keep that in mind.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I'll completely endorse everything that Sue said, and I won't repeat it, but I wonder, Anna, can I just dip into the chat? Because there's another question that I think is relevant that Alice Gifford has asked about trust and the decline of trust and how that seems to link to the rise of all this kind of automated technology. And I think Alice is right. And I think what's happened over the last 20 years has been that, you know, the fantastic advances in technology, which have so many benefits and connecting us to so many people around the world, have also had a sort of perverse consequence of creating a lot of big global companies that we don't know and we don't see, and they seem very inhuman to us. And that's obviously had, in some ways, a negative effect on journalism, but I think it also contains the seeds of the solution, and that people are craving connection. You know, people really know what really drives trust is the belief that the person that you're being asked to trust is on your side and that they will do what they say they're going to do. If you have that belief, if they can demonstrate to you that they're worthy of your trust, people are longing to have something to trust in. I think that's the reason people are gravitating so rapidly to all sorts of, you know, to me, rather strange and outlandish beliefs at the moment, because they give them that thing that they're not getting from other parts of society. So I think actually running a local news operation, being in the community, being visible, and to answer Isabel Odeberg's question further down the chat, how important is print? Print actually can help with that. I know some local publishers who really use print as a way of creating a physical connection with the audience. I know one guy who literally drives around his area in South Wales delivering copies of the paper because it gives him an opportunity to talk to people and see how they're doing and get stories and build trust. So I think, yeah, huge trust problem in our society driven by digital technology, but in that is also the seeds of some of the real added value that genuine community media can bring.
So look, there's a number of questions, but unfortunately we are running out of time. Just in an effort to sort of round out the conversation, I am interested in asking each one of you, what do we look like in 5 years' time? If there's one thing that you could change or achieve, what would that be? And that I might start with you from a community perspective. What's the big game changer for you?
Thanks, Anna. Look, I do think, and as I mentioned earlier, there is an opportunity to really get behind the momentum in place-based approaches and place-based investments. And I think if we can see local news production and access as a core element of those design, policy designs, funding designs, in 5 years' time, we might actually see some more sustainable and I think more connected and cohesive narrative as a country. Local production and local access is really critical to having a better understanding of actually what's going on across our country, which therefore can lead to a lot of different and better outcomes. I was also quite curious about the question about whether we need print anymore, and I would say in 5 years I really hope we've still got print. I do think it's fundamental in rural communities in particular. One of the things I know is all of our local residents turn to the death notices, which is a really, you know, depressing thing. But in fact, it's a part of our life that we acknowledge people who have played a role in our community. We celebrate identity. We acknowledge the role that people have played. And I know that local people don't go online to look at those. The letters to the editor are a brilliant democratic process. We've got two men who have been arguing with each other for, I don't know, at least a decade now, every week on the letters page. The Facebook channels don't enable that. It's unhealthy in that environment. But the letters to the editor are a beautiful democratic process. So for me, I think we need to find balance.
Thanks, Matt. Good reminders on format is as important as content. Jonathan, Sue, two quick comments from each of you. And just to wrap up, key questions coming on the chat, whether a UK or US version of the news media bargaining code might be part of that five-year horizon.
Shall I just jump in on the news media bargaining code front? Yes, as you know, your staggering success in Australia with the news media bargaining code is now being eagerly copied by governments around the world. I think, you know, you and I, Anna, have talked about this a lot. I think we recognise there are drawbacks in the outcome of the politicking that went on in Australia between the government, the platforms and some of the big publishers. And we really want to avoid that in the UK. So we are working to make sure that whatever code is eventually unveiled here, nothing's been published yet, but we understand there is a draft circulating within government, that it has got to acknowledge the role of community independent media publications with turnover below 100,000 UK pounds. And it's got to make sure that those publications are meaningfully able to benefit from the digital economy and not just given scraps from the table, because I really think they are where the future lies. And if you allow a news media bargaining code to actually prop up the dominant corporate news publishers, it's worse than a sticking plaster. It's going to exacerbate some of the worst things about the existing media economy. And we've got to turn it around.
So what does your world look like in 5 years' time?
Our world looks like it does include some government funding, but I think in the US it may come from different types of structures. But there is, I won't say it's racing through, but there's at the both the state and federal level here, there is interest in that. I'm very bullish on what will happen in the next 5 years. And it's actually not so much about the journalism. It's about the communities. What we are really seeing is we're not getting calls just from journalists who want to start a new newsroom, span a news desert. We're getting calls from civic leaders. Two of the last I worked with were a bunch of civic leaders on the West Coast, a small town, and then a tiny community of 5,000 people across a whole bunch of islands off the East Coast that created a nonprofit to replace a newspaper that closed 2 years ago. Neither of those were driven by journalists. They were driven by the community saying, we really need trustworthy news. We need that connection. And so I feel like we're just starting to see that, where people are switching from, oh, why did the newspaper disappear or get too thin, to, oh, what can we do? We can support local news. I don't think that is easy growth, but we expect the number of nonprofit news outlets here to double by 4 years from now when we look at the pace of growth. And you are seeing just a change in the culture to realize the role of news and support it. The challenge in that is that we are also seeing thousands, literally thousands of local news outlets created that are funded in a kind of murky way and probably through political funds and so forth. So I think this issue that several have brought up about building trust, being transparent, saying we're in your community, driven by your community, is going to be crucial. And as those grow, I think you will start to see this kind of reinvention or restoration of local news.
Natalie, Jonathan and Sue, thank you. Your wealth of knowledge, as always, continues to impress, and these conversations, we're always cut short of time. There are more questions on the chat, particularly around wanting links to each one of yours, research, etc. The Walkley Foundation will be doing a summits roundup and we'll include all those links. So thank you for asking. A big thank you across the different time zones, particularly for Jonathan in the ungodly hours of the middle of the night. But you really have all stimulated how we can start to think about the future of public interest journalism in regional communities, and not to lose sight that it's not all doom and gloom, and there certainly are opportunities for growth and innovation. So thank you all. Thank you also to the Walkley Foundation for pulling together this summit for us to participate in. And also just a quick shout out to Pidgey's supporters who enable us to go about the work that we do and have these fascinating conversations, and in order to drive and inform the communities that are out there thinking about what they need at their local level. A quick shout out to the Pidgey research team headed up by Gary Dixon, who continues to push out global first work. So thank you. Thank you all to everyone online. We really appreciate your interest, and we hope that today we've just stimulated the next conversations that you'll be having in your workplaces and your communities. Please do reach out to any one of us. We'd be keen to continue the discussion offline.
You've been listening to Walkley Talks podcast with me, James Gorman. You can find links to the stories mentioned in this discussion in the show notes. Sign up to our newsletter at walkleys.com/subscribe to be the first to learn about our new episodes, events, and other opportunities. If you've enjoyed this episode of Walkley Talks, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app. And while you're there, please take a moment to rate us. This podcast is produced by Andrew Herlinger with help from the 2SER Studio in Sydney, Australia.